Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And we'll begin today with this question. When confronting terrorism, how should a democracy decide when to compromise its ideals in pursuit of victory?
It's a deeply important question with many complexities, some of which are being played out right now on Capitol Hill. Yesterday, the House approved President Obama's plan to train and equip Syrian rebels to fight the so-called Islamic State, or ISIS. The Senate is expected to vote today, and it could put the U.S. one step closer to its third significant military operation in Iraq and clear the way for U.S. engagement in the Syrian civil war.
But is it the right thing for the U.S. to do? Many lawmakers are skeptical, including Tennessee Republican Senator Bob Corker. He grilled Secretary of State John Kerry yesterday about why President Obama hadn't come to Congress seeking explicit authorization for military force against ISIS. Here's how Kerry responded.
Now, with respect to the judgment about asking Congress to do it, I'm asking, do it. Pass it. But we're not going to get stuck in the situation when we have the authority of not exercising our authority to do what we believe we need to do to protect the country. So we're asking you to do it. Pass it tomorrow.
You're asking us to do it, but you're not giving any details because you don't have them.
That's not true, Senator.
Then share them.
Well, heated exchanges like that are messy, but essential struggles that democracies must go through when facing new threats. And they're emblematic of what Alan Dershowitz calls the War of Principles. That's the title of his recent five-part series in the Boston Globe that grapples with questions of the use of military force, government surveillance, targeted assassination, infinite detention, and torture. And again, Dershowitz says it all boils down to the question, how should a democracy decide when to compromise its ideals in pursuit of victory? Alan Dershowitz is a celebrated attorney and professor emeritus at Harvard Law School. He joins us today from New York. Professor Dershowitz, welcome back to the program.
Oh, well, thank you. I miss Boston and Cambridge, so I'm glad to be on remotely from New York.
Well, we're glad to have you here in voice and spirit, if mm-hmm. not in body. Well, first of all, let me just, we read through your entire series and found it very compelling, and I wanted to start with a basic question of why is it, do you think, that terrorism and the rule of law seem, and I say seem, to be so difficult to balance? What is it about terrorists or terrorist groups that make it more of a challenge than, say, other threats that democracies have faced in the past?
Well, first of all, I think every war imposes constraints on the rule of law. The blast of the cannon silences the rule of law. It's been said a long time ago, but terrorism has something unique because terrorists don't comply with the laws of war. They don't wear uniforms often. They hide among civilians. They're prepared to murder civilians. And we have to fight, as I said in my first article, with one hand tied behind our back because we must comply with the rule of law. We may argue with a particular application of the rule of law. And in fact, I really don't think we should ever compromise our principles. I think we may have to adapt our principles to the new reality of how terrorists fight against us. We must maintain the upper hand because the most basic and fundamental right of all is the right to life and the right to protect our citizens' lives from terrorism, and because the rules of lawfare were designed for battlefields. Mm. They were designed for, you know, Gettysburg or maybe the First or Second World Wars, but they weren't designed for what is called asymmetrical warfare. So we have to adapt. The law must always change.
Right. Well, in that first article, you really you asked the question about when is military force justified in use against terrorist groups such as ISIS, and you use the example of the recent conflict between Israel and Hamas. And in it, you say mm-hmm. that it's a stark choice, that Israel faced a stark choice to allow the tunnels between the Gaza Strip and Israel to remain in operation, risking the lives of Israeli citizens, or send Israeli ground troops to Gaza, resulting in the deaths of Palestinian mm-hmm. civilians. Mm-hmm. And you say Israel opted for the second choice, as most democracies would. And you imply that this is essentially the same choice or a similar choice that the U.S. is facing regarding groups like ISIS. I mean, is it really that similar?
Well, there are great similarities, and there are always some differences. At the same time I was writing the five columns for The Globe, I was finishing a book called Terror Tunnels, The Case for Israel's Just War Against Hamas. It's amazing what you can do with an e-book these days. This is an e-book. I finished writing it literally last Thursday night after listening to President Obama's speech on ISIS, and it was already published on as an e-book on Monday. And in it, I make a much, much fuller case for the similarities between Hamas and ISIS and between what Israel had to do and what ISIS does. What Israel had to do was decide whether to attack legitimate military targets, tunnels, rocket launchers, that Hamas had willfully and deliberately placed behind human shields. And Hamas leaders bragged about it and boasted about it. Now ISIS is doing the same thing. They're putting their fighters in densely populated areas. They're no longer exposing them to the open field where they can be attacked by American military air power. And so the United States is going to have to face that same challenge. Now, for the United States, it's a little bit more optional because ISIS is not directly threatening us on the battlefield. They aren't sending rockets at our children's home or digging tunnels into New York City or Boston, but they still pose a threat to us. And so will we carry out what the president said, targeted killings against ISIS leaders, not allowing them to have asylum anywhere, when in the process we know some civilians will die? That will be the stark choice we have to face with ISIS. It's the very similar to the stark choice that Israel had to face with Hamas. Now, there are big differences. They both use the media. Hamas, of course, uses the media to try to focus attention on Israel's, quote, war crimes. They use what I call the dead baby strategy. They purposely create a situation where Israel inevitably will have to kill some civilians, including children, and they use the media to try to blame Israel. What ISIS does is uses the media to try to recruit. And these beheadings and this most recent trailer, you know, movie trailer coming soon, essentially, to a home near you, shows how both ISIS and Hamas use the media, but in very, very different ways. And, you know, the analogy.
Well, if I may just,
I'm sorry,
Professor Dershowitz, but if I just may just jump in here, the reason why I wanted to start with this particular example, and I do want to leave us time to get to the other issues that you raised in your series, is because I think it raises the question of when asking ourselves as a democracy, what compromises are we willing to make to the rule of law? We have to ask ourselves really what constitutes a threat. And you know, I noticed that this week, Tom Friedman in the New York Times, and this is someone who supported the Iraq war with full throat, he basically writes, an existential struggle is taking place in the Arab world today, but is it ours or is it theirs? And then he says what concerns him the most about President Obama's decision to re-engage in Iraq is that it feels as if it's being done in response to some deliberately exaggerated fears.
I think there's certainly an argument to be made that it's not an immediate threat to us. It's certainly a greater threat to Jordan, a greater threat to Saudi Arabia, to some of the Emirates, not Qatar, because it plays both sides against the middle. And we have to ask ourselves whether that constitutes a sufficiently direct threat to our allies. There's another threat. Look, I'm right now right a couple of blocks away from Times Square. There's additional security in Times Square because ISIS has threatened Times Square. And what I'm very worried about is ISIS has now put on the web all kind of instructions as to how to be a lone wolf terrorist. And those are the scariest kind of all. When there are groups of terrorists, we can often infiltrate them, get information, get intelligence. But when there's a lone terrorist sitting at home on his computer being told how to achieve his jihadist goal, that's impossible to anticipate in advance. So, yes, it is a threat. It's not nearly as immediate a threat as the tunnels and the rockets from Hamas. But the United States is, after all, the leader of the world. Israel is only a regional power. So you define threat differently depending on where you sit.
Well, so that leads us to part two of your series, War on Principles, that appeared in The Globe. Because I actually found part two to be very compelling because you talked about government surveillance, specifically the NSA's programs that were revealed by Edward Snowden. And you asked some really big questions. Like, whenever these things are revealed, was the surveillance proper? Was it right to be secret? Does a secrecy justify unlawful disclosure? And there's no simple or perfect answer to these questions, as you say.
No.
But I'm just curious, like when we look at it in terms of the lens of the rule of law, I mean, what is your take on that? Is the surveillance proper in this case?
No, it was not proper. It was way, way, way overdone. The justification that was used was, well, look, we're not listening to your phone calls, the content. We're just identifying who you called, who called you, when they called. But when you do it on such a massive scale, it can give you so much information about a person's personal life. It was way, way, way overdone. That doesn't mean there's not some legitimate need for surveillance based on some kind of cause. It doesn't have to be the same level of probable cause required for a criminal search warrant, but it's a balance that has to be struck. And the national, you know, the courts so far have just deferred to the executive, and there have been no checks or balances. And so I understand what Snowden did, but, you know, just like it's not right for just the administration to make the decision because they always balance much more on the side of security than on liberty, it's also not right for an individual like Snowden to make his own decision as to what to reveal. For example, he revealed wiretaps on foreign leaders. That's not protected by the Constitution. The United States is perfectly entitled to listen into Angela Merkel or Benjamin Netanyahu. They listen in on us. We can listen to them. That's spy versus spy. That's not a constitutional issue. And yet Snowden revealed a lot of that to the embarrassment of the United States. Mm-hmm. So the balance has to be struck, and I prefer to strike it by having all three branches of the government deeply involved. Legislation, authorizing it, the president acting prudently, and then the courts approving it.
Isn't that hard? Impossible in this day and age, because we're living in an era where government seems to be operating from the default presumption of secrecy. I mean, I was looking back in 2011, the New York Times wrote that President Obama, a couple years before that, had ordered all agencies to review secret material by June of 2012 with the goal of promoting more declassification. But unfortunately, the administration's emphasis, and this is the Times speaking, since then has been in the opposite direction. They classified nearly 77 million documents in 2010, a 40% mm-hmm. jump in 1 year.
Sure. When in doubt, don't let it out. That's the mantra of every government, Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal. You always err on the side of keeping material secret, and that's a big mistake. I think we ought to err on the side of disclosure. The government ought to have to justify by a high level of justification maintaining secrets, and as I said in my article, never any permanent secrets. Ultimately, history must prevail. Now, when it's revealed, who makes the decision? Those are the hard questions. Yeah.
So there's another idea that you brought up in this part of the series, which I wanted to just explore with you for a moment. You write that the nature and extent of permissible intrusion of privacy will depend on the nature and extent of the threat. Mm-hmm. And that seems to make a great deal of sense. But I wonder, I mean, you know, we were talking about threats earlier. Hasn't government or security agencies, haven't they always been in the business of inflating threats to justify surveillance? I mean, there's imperfect information at the heart of this challenge, and one that basically will always put civil libertarians at a disadvantage.
I agree, but I don't think it's motivated by a desire to have more surveillance. I think security agencies, by their nature, think the threat is always greater than it is because they don't want to be the ones at the end of 9/11 to be told, my God, you knew about it and you didn't do anything about it. So you're always going to find security agencies erring on the side of exaggerating the threat. I don't think it's to give them more power or authority or more ego something or other. I think it's a legitimate belief on their part, but it ought not to prevail. That ought to be balanced against the civil liberties concerned. And a court, a real court, ought to be making that balanced judgment as to when secrecy prevails over the right to know and when privacy prevails over the right to surveil. There are no simple answers to these questions. You know, also, we live in an age where young people expect less of privacy than people of my generation. I don't know which generation you're in, but many people who are my children's and my grandchildren's age, they're on Facebook. Everything's out there. You talk about privacy, they don't know what you're talking about. And the Constitution defines the Fourth Amendment in terms of reasonable expectation of privacy. So I think the Googleization of the world and the, you know, iPhones and selfies and everything else is going to weaken our Constitution even more than the war against terrorism. But in combination, I think our Fourth Amendment and our right of privacy is in real danger.
Weaken our Constitution in terms of people's tolerance for intrusions
That's
on their
right.
privacy.
That's
Listeners,
right.
I'm speaking with Alan Dershowitz. He's professor emeritus at Harvard Law School. He's author of a 5-part series that recently appeared in the Boston Globe entitled War of Principles, about the fight against terrorist groups and the rule of law. He's also author of the new ebook entitled Terror Tunnels, The Case for Israel's Just War Against Hamas. Both those things are linked at our website, radioboston.org. Professor Dershowitz, you also wrote quite a bit about infinite detention, specifically because of the fact that the prison at Guantanamo Bay remains open. And you sort of ask some really good questions about how to handle this. And you point to one possibility, that preventative detention law could be passed that would afford detainees some kind of due process, but would authorize a tribunal to nevertheless order continued confinement if there's evidence of future dangerousness. So explain to us how that might work.
Well, first of all, Guantanamo ought to be closed. The president promised it would be. He should keep his promise. It ought to be closed. It's a terrible symbol around the world. But second, what do we do with the people? What do we do with the people in Guantanamo who have said publicly, we're going to go back to jihadist activities. We're going to kill as many Americans as we can. It's not a crime to say that. And we may not be able to prosecute them for past crimes because the witnesses against them may be undercover agents who we don't want to blow their cover. I gave as an example, what if somebody identified who the person was who beheaded the two Americans and the one British citizen, and we were able to capture him, but the only witness against him was a deep undercover, perhaps operative of ISIS? We'd have to make a decision. We can't treat him as a prisoner of war. He's an unlawful combatant. We can't hold him forever and ever and ever, but could we release him? Could we have a mini trial at which he's entitled to all the safeguards of a criminal trial other than confronting his witness directly? It's a bad situation because it legitimates a very imperfect system of justice, perhaps injustice. But it may be better than the current situation where there are virtually no criteria for holding somebody and no limit on how long we can hold them. This is one of the real conundrums, and there's no good answer.
Well, I wonder about that because I think other people might say that there is a good answer, and it is our extant rule system of law, our existing legal system. Like, why is it inadequate? Why can't the government just try these cases, as it has a couple times at least, in the United States, in U.S. courts? Prove the strength of our democracy by trying these people on U.S. soil.
They should. And in every case that there's any possibility of a trial, there should be a trial. That should be obviously the default position. But to get back to my beheader, if we have him, do you think the American public would tolerate his release to go back to fight and to go back and behead because we say we have a witness, a credible witness who's telling the truth, but we can't produce him because if we produce him, we will lose the most important intelligence source we have? That's the kind of conundrum we face. My preference would be to simply always apply the rule of law. But when you're dealing with terrorists who have boasted that they want to go back and commit more terrorism, some who've been released have committed more acts of terrorism, it's not something the public will accept.
Well, I don't necessarily want to engage in debate with you, Professor
Dershowitz.
Because the question that did jump to my mind is, I think that, say, in murder cases in certain communities, people might look upon the accused murderers as terrorists in those communities. We're not talking about international jihadists. But
when I won the O.J. Simpson case, everybody complained that I brought about the release of a murderer who might do it again, and we did it by applying the rule of law. And sure, you might say an O.J. Simpson, a Klaus von Bülow, or the other defendants whose cases I won, or people think are guilty of murder, are just as dangerous as the terrorists. But they're not, because they're not part of a coordinated effort boasted about by them that they're going to continue to do it again. Yeah, it's a matter of degree, but degrees count.
So oftentimes in your series, you use language which really struck me. And it's not exclusive to you. People have said this oftentimes, that we are constrained. Democracies are constrained by the rule of law. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if another way of looking at it is that democracies are liberated by the rule of law, that by truly following our democratic principles, we have a certain kind of moral clarity which strengthens us overall, both domestically and on the world stage.
I completely agree with that. And if the rule of law were clear and adapted to the current reality, that would not be too hard to follow. But the rule of law is vague. What does constitute reasonable expectation of privacy? What does constitute due process? What does constitute, you know, a range of other democratic values? They are adaptable. President Lincoln thought he could suspend the writ of habeas corpus during the Civil War, and the Supreme Court said no. And for me, the greatest protection is our separation of powers and our system of checks and balances. that require, at the very least, if we're going to adapt, we have to get the approval of all three branches of government and ultimately the most important branch of government, that is, the public as informed by the media. That's why secrecy is so corrosive of liberty. If we're going to make compromises, let's do it openly. Let's do it legitimately. That's why in my last article, I say I am adamantly opposed to torture, but I actually support torture warrants. Why? Because I believe that every president would authorize torture if we had a true ticking bomb situation. And if that's going to happen, I want to make sure it's constrained by the rule of law, it's subject to judicial review, and it's used in only the most limited possible situations. And people say, how can you be against torture and in favor of torture warrants? Look, I'm against the death penalty, but I'm in favor of according due process and having warrants before you can execute anybody. So there's no contradiction, yeah. But we have to strike a balance.
Well, finally, you do conclude your series with this idea that that democratic accountability when confronting terrorism suggests, and this is your language, that we should generally opt for the least worst approach. And forgive me for saying this, but that seemed to be kind of a pessimistic perspective on the power of democratic systems of government. I mean, Do you really feel that terrorism is such an overwhelming issue that democracies can't find the best approaches rather than adopting the least worst?
Well, James Madison was the one who said if men were angels, you know, we could do without a constitution. I think least worse is pretty good. Now, I'm not necessarily a supporter of the president's foreign policy of don't do bad stuff. I think we can do better. But when it comes to balancing rights versus the need for security, least worst is often the only option we have. And I think reality hurts. We wish we could live in an idealized democracy, which we never had to adapt or compromise. But the reality is the public will not accept that. And they may be right. The Constitution has to be adapted over time. And I think on balance, we're doing a pretty good job. Pretty good job.
Alan Dershowitz is professor emeritus at Harvard Law School. He's author of War of Principles, a five-part series that recently appeared in the Boston Globe, and author of the new ebook entitled Terror Tunnels. Both of those are linked at our website, radioboston.org. Professor Dershowitz, always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, listeners, stick with us because coming up, we'll turn the corner a little bit and talk about the history of our nation's founding fruit, the apple. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.